If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. It's Thursday, October the 8th, and you're listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, a president who's up for re-election 26 days from now. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution and the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow. Joining me today via Zoom from the other side of the Stanford University campus is my esteemed colleague, Dr. David Brady. Dave Brady is the Davies Family Senior Fellow here at the Hoover Institution and the Bowen H. and Janice Arthur McCoy Professor of Political Science at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. He analyzes and writes frequently on American politics and elections. It's a column of his that caught my attention, a column he wrote for Hoover's Defining Ideas Journal, the title of which is Biden versus Trump, a snapshot from 2016. Dave, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, Bill. How are you?
Let's get into your column, but first I want to ask you a question. You just had a milestone birthday. I'm not going to give away the age, but I did the math, my friend. If Joe Biden wins this election, you'll be working on your 15th president. Do you realize that?
I do, actually, realize that. All too much.
I'm curious about this, since you're a political scientist and you study presidencies, you study politics. I'm just curious, in the time that you've been watching presidents, the time in which you've lived, which president do you think kind of best fit his times? Is it FDR in the war years? Is it Eisenhower in the 50s? Is it Reagan in the 80s? It's kind of the small bell Bill Clinton in the 1990s. Which president do you think was the best fit for the times in which he ruled?
I would say FDR in the 30s, though, needless to say, I wasn't terribly familiar with him. I was 4 years old when he died, so that's more of a reading of history. Uh-huh. And then I think Ronald Reagan fit his times because there had been a period of rising taxes, et cetera, et cetera. There was a tax revolt that started without Reagan. And President Reagan came in and captured the era quite well, held it for all of his 8 years. After the first 2 years of taking care of inflation, getting rid of stagflation, and then the economy boomed, I think he fit his times exceedingly well. And I would also have to say, I think Jack Kennedy in the early 60s, because he brought about this sense of hope and American greatness, and it lasted, of course, until a very short time.
Right.
But for those 3 years.
You look at FDR and you look at Reagan, Dave, and you look at their elections, and the two Reagan elections, I think he wins 93 out of 100 states. You look at the map for FDR in 1932 and 1936, it regresses in 1940 and 1944, but these two gentlemen just absolutely control American politics in their elections. Do you think this kind of command is gone in these divided days? And in other words, you could have a large number in the Electoral College in this election if things break heavily Joe Biden's way, but maybe not in the popular vote. And so that kind of raises the question of mandate and commanding heights. Do you think a future president will have the same kind of command that Reagan and FDR did of the system?
In the present era, from basically with Roosevelt through to about 19. So Roosevelt and the Democrats controlled the Congress and presidency essentially from 32 to 54. From 54 on, you had a pattern of divided government, which was essentially Republican presidents with Democratic Congresses.
Right.
And now, post 92, in this era, if you look from 1952 to 1992, 8 of the 11 elections were won with 50% of the vote or more. 5 of the 11, the winner got 55%. And as you suggest, 55-45, that's a landslide. Mm-hmm. In the present era, from 1992 on, in those presidential elections, we've had two winners who didn't win a majority. No president has actually had a majority, and no one has won, needless to say, obviously, 55%. So presidential elections are now much closer, and even though Biden might have a big margin in the Electoral College, I don't expect that he will win 55% of the vote.
You know, the other curious pattern, Dave, is one of continuity, if you will, in the executive branch, but volatility in Congress, which, again, is the reversal from the 54 to 94 stretch of Congress, where Democrats, I think, with the exception of 1980 to 86, where Republicans had the Senate, Democrats ruled the roost on Capitol Hill. But we're in this very odd period of American history. Clinton, Bush, and Obama are all elected and reelected. There have only been two stretches of history in America where you've had three consecutive two-term, eight-year presidencies, the other one being presidents 3, 4, and 5. Yes, that's before your time. Yes. The so-called era of good feelings, where you had these rather similar gentlemen, all planters from Virginia, running as Democrat Republicans, and things supposedly got along well, 1801 to 1825. But in modern times, you've had presidents getting elected and reelected with Congress flipping. But 2020 could change the script if the polls maintain what we see so far, and that's Biden holding lead. So let's get into the defining ideas piece that you wrote. And it's rather brilliant, I think, in this regard. You simply look at numbers, and you look at Biden now versus Hillary Clinton then, and come up with conclusions. What I liked about it, Dave, was that you gave us two tables. One was Clinton and Biden comparisons 2016-2020, and the other one, Clinton-Biden comparisons 2016-2020 vis-a-vis battleground state. So why don't you walk us through the first of the two tables, which is the overall Clinton-Biden numbers.
So what I try to do in the table, if you actually think about how the economist model of the U.S. elections works in 538, they're both basically using the 2016 election, because we know Ms. Clinton won a plurality of the votes. But she didn't win in the Electoral College, so comparison between the two lets us know two things: how Biden's doing relative to her, and then Trump by himself compared 2016 and 2020. And on that basis, we can make some estimates about what the Electoral College would look like. So in the first table, and I should say that we match these up. And in the sample that I'm using from 2016, the 2016 post-election vote, that result showed that Mrs. Clinton won by 1.8%. She won by a little over that 2.7, but it's accurate. So we're in the ballpark on it represents the actual vote in 2016. So then looking at 2020, I find that about 88.5% of Clinton voters in 2016 are voting for Biden, mm-hmm. and 2.3% of them are voting for Trump, and the rest are saying won't vote, don't know, haven't made up my mind. And and the Trump vote is in 2016 is 4.1%. So Trump voters, 4.1% of Trump voters are voting for Biden, mm-hmm. and 83.1% of them are voting for Trump. So first, Biden's getting more of the Hillary Clinton's votes than Trump's getting of his own vote. And second, more Trump voters are voting for Clinton. I'm sorry, are voting for Biden.
Right.
than our Clinton voters voting for Biden. Now, the other thing is, given the third party candidates, Stein, et cetera, what's happened there is they have moved over into, by about a 2-to-1 ratio, they're moving into the vote for Biden as opposed to vote for Trump. I just got the most recent poll from the first week in October, mm-hmm. and roughly speaking, the numbers I gave you are about the same, although mm-hmm. President Trump has started to that the people who voted for Trump, that 4.1% I just talked about, right. has dropped, so that the number of Trump voters voting for Biden is about equal to the number of Clinton voters voting for Trump. So that's now a split. Biden's still ahead among third-party voters like Jill Stein and Johnson, et cetera. And Trump has moved up a little bit to about 85% of Republicans. So that's pretty good. That tightens it a little bit for the president. But among independents, it seems that they're breaking a little bit now more for Biden.
So those numbers, Dave, you mentioned about Biden getting Clinton support and Trump and Trump supporters in 2016. Again, it's 80. Biden would get 88.5% of Clinton's voters, according to your polls. Trump would get 83.1% of his previous voters. Does that disrupt the narrative that Republicans are more united behind Trump than Democrats are behind Biden?
No, it does not, because remember this 2016 vote, Clinton and Trump includes independents are built into it.
Okay.
And you had about 13% independents. Now, Trump won the independent vote last time over Clinton by 54-30, something like that, with the rest not voting or voting other. So that independent vote is built into that. And so that plays into both sets of numbers, both for Trump and Biden. So no, Republicans are a little bit more aligned with Trump, but a Trump voter in 2016 need not necessarily be a Republican. I would add one other thing that seems to be a little different in this election. The gap between the Democrats outnumbered the Republicans about 7%, 7.5-8%. That is, there were 7.5-8% more Democrats, people who said they're Democrats, than Republicans in 2016. In this election, the number of Democrats is about 10 points greater than Republicans. And that's because what's happening, people are independent. We say they're independent. Then when you ask them, are you leaning Democrat or lean Republican? Bunch of those independents are now saying they're leaning Democrat or leaning Republican because they know how they're going to vote. And Biden has done a little better among those people, independent leaners who've already committed.
Yeah, the those third party numbers are also interesting, Dave. The 2016 Gary Johnson, Jill Stein voters, you had it at 35.1% for Biden, 10.9% for Trump. But here, Dave, we have a quality and quantity conversation, because let's say you voted green in 2016. You live in Berkeley, California. You switch to Joe Biden. Your vote doesn't really matter. Biden's going to get 60% plus in California regardless. On the other hand, if you voted green, you voted libertarian in Madison, Wisconsin in 2016, or Detroit, Michigan, or Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. No, so I mean, so it's, while we look at these numbers, you also have to, you have to think that it's not just the overall number, it's just exactly where those numbers are targeted. In other words, if a lot of this, flipping over to Biden from the third parties happens in California, New York, Massachusetts, it doesn't matter. Those states are not in play.
Right.
The question is, how much will they flip in the states that matter most?
Yeah. So and the first thing to note is most of the Stein votes and things like that occur where Stein votes occur in California, New York, where you expect more liberals are. And the Johnson vote, libertarian. So that might make a difference, but the numbers are pretty small in both cases. So in just an average survey like this one, I can tell you how they're going, but you're absolutely correct until we oversample them. Until we get the sample sizes up to about 5,000 or 6,000, we're not going to be able to say those switches are going to be relevant in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. So at this point, we cannot say that about them.
Okay, so let's talk about that in your second table, which is the battleground states. And a very simple narrative from 2016, Dave. Donald Trump wins these states because why? He does better than Mitt Romney, and she doesn't do as well as Barack Obama. Now, she doesn't, actually, in some cases, she does do better than Obama, but she doesn't make up the same increase that Trump does. You see this in Florida. You see this in Pennsylvania. You see this in Wisconsin. Notice she doesn't keep up. So the trick here for Biden, he has to pad. He has to increase what she did.
Right. And so the point about, so in the battleground states, it looks good for Biden because it says, gee, he's getting 91.7% of the vote she got.
Yeah.
But remember, she lost a bunch of these states. So he has to do really better, as you say.
Right.
And in these states, Trump gets 2.8% of 2016 Clinton voters. And in these states on the 2016 vote, Trump gets 2.3%. So actually, Biden only gets 2.3% of Trump voters. So what you have in this case is Trump is doing a little bit better than he was in the overall sample, and that makes the election closer.
Right. You also know in your table, of those voting for Clinton in 2016, only 5% have not committed. And in these states, majorities of Democrats say they are voting against Trump.
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
That sounds like a really low amount of voters to not be locked in at this point. In other words, I thought undecideds, Dave, tend to run more like about 10%.
Yeah, I think, well, so note that the third, so in the totals for vote for Clinton, vote for Trump, those totals do not include third party vote, which gets up to around 4 or 5% of the vote. So you'd have to add that in. Right. And the second thing that doesn't include is this does not include new voters coming into the state, whether they are into the new voters either moving into the states, battleground states, or becoming eligible for the vote in those states, or people who didn't vote in 2016 and are going to vote this time.
Right. You also added the 15% of 2016 Trump voters who have not decided. There's a high number there. 15% haven't decided, Dave. Women and moderate Republicans are overrepresented, and it is these voters who were with Trump in the previous election the president will have to bring back into the fold if he is to win in the battleground states. That sounds like you're saying he's in trouble.
Right. But he did. I do think that's a problem for him. But he was able to bring them back in the 2016 election. That's exactly, if we looked at it going into it, we knew it was going to be close. But we thought in the end that she would win, that Mrs. Clinton would win. What we didn't get was, in the end, more Republicans voted for Trump than Democrats voted for Clinton. And Trump won the independent vote and therefore was able to get an Electoral College majority. Now, I think everybody, I don't think there's anybody that does analysis of this election that think Trump's gonna win a majority of the popular vote. He's not gonna win that. The question is, his strategy is an Electoral College state. So the thing you have to watch for is exactly these battleground states, as you've been saying for a couple months.
He wins the popular vote, Dave, if you cut California off and let it drift out to sea and don't include the votes. But otherwise,
California and New York, you throw them out. And
Illinois, Massachusetts. So he's going to lose, and he'll lose by a larger margin. So so let's talk about a couple of national polls that came out this week, Dave. A couple of polls that had some eye-popping numbers. There was a CNN poll first that came out, a poll of likely voters, Dave. It had Biden ahead 57 to 41. Let me repeat that, 57% to 41%.
Yeah, I don't believe that.
It's followed not long after by a Wall Street Journal NBC poll, this one of registered voters, the CNN poll's likely voters. Wall Street Journal NBC poll of registered voters, David had the race at 53 to 39. So here's what's caught my eye about it. 57%. You go back into modern presidential elections, Dave, you rarely find a president who clears 53%. George H.W. Bush was the last one to do it, Dave. He did it in 1988. He got 53.3%. You're going to say, wait a second, what about Barack Obama in 2008? He got 52.9%. So 53 is kind of the magic number. And here's Biden at 57%. Reagan, Dave, in 1984, he got 58.8%. Nixon cleared 57% in 1972. LBJ in 1962. Eisenhower in 1956. I wonder how many of those you voted for, by the way. But these were all sitting presidents, Dave, unlike Joe Biden, who is a challenger. The other number, Dave, is 39%, the number that Trump got in the Wall Street Journal NBC poll. 39%, yikes, in this regard. The last president who failed to clear 39% would have been George H.W. Bush in 1992, Dave. He got 37.5%. But why did he get that low number, Dave?
You tell me.
Ross Perot, right?
Yeah.
Right, 18.9%. Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter got skunked in 1980, Dave. He lost 44 of 50 states. He got 41%, and that's with John Anderson getting 6.5% of the national vote. Herbert Hoover, the man on institution, is named after the founder of our institution. He gets wiped out in 1932. He still gets 39.6% of the vote. He wins only 6 of 48 states and 59 of 531 electoral votes. So here you have a really odd number to me, Dave, 39%. I could draw out a scenario where Trump would win about 20 states and 175 electoral votes. That 39% stands out, and so does that 57%. Your thoughts on these two polls?
Well, the CNN poll moves all over. They had them at, they had Biden up by 4, and then I don't believe either of those numbers are that high. I don't think the margin is that big. I do think it's around 8-9%. Another thing that causes problems on these, if they're telephone polls, you sometimes have to interview 20 people to get one respondent. And after a debate, as in the 2012 first Romney-Obama debate, where Romney was ahead in all the polls, that's because Republicans were much more likely to want to talk to a phone interviewer about the debate, because everybody saw that Romney had done well and Obama had not. And after this first debate, when CNN's poll was out, I think more Democrats were wanting to talk than Republicans. So I think that helps account for it. In regard to that 38%, some of that is whether you're talking about how you measure registered voter versus likely voter. So I'll give you an example. In the YouGov Economist poll this week, we have that poll with Biden with a among likely voters with a 51-42 lead. But among if you do just registered voters, then it turns out that Biden's lead is about 7.9, 45.9, and Trump has 38. And what you have then is other people saying, so how do you get a total of, if you're doing registered voters, we have Biden at 45.9, Trump at 38, other 1.8, not sure 6.3, I would not vote 8%. So what some of them do are they take those away, try and figure out how many are going to vote. If I switch to likely voters in the thing I just gave you, I get a different total. I get a 51-42. I get a 9-point Biden lead. So it does matter whether you're using registered voters or whether you're using likely voters.
Yeah, and that 9%, by the way, is pretty much what Real Clear Politics shows, their average for general election polling. They have a Dave at 9.7% for Biden. That's about a 2.5% gain over the past week when you've had the debate in Cleveland and the president's.
And that's right. But we don't show that big a jump, but it looks like it's about 2-2.3% for us.
Right. And then Real Clear 538, which also does national polling, they have it at 9.8. So it looks like about a 9-point spread in this race right now. But that's not quite what the battleground states show, though, does it? That's about double the margin of the battlegrounds, right?
Yes, the battleground and the entire Trump strategy is in fact is the battleground states.
And so the question, Dave, is. So the question is going to be, how does this change in the next 26 days to Trump's advantage? Because here's what you wrote at the conclusion of your defining ideas column. Quote, over the next month, many continuing events may shift these results. The televised debates, the course of the coronavirus pandemic, including Trump's illness, protests in Portland and elsewhere, and the fight to confirm Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. One thing is clear, the election is still being fought in the battleground states. So Trump said today he will not participate in the Miami debate if it's virtual. He wants to do it in person. So we may have more debates. We may not. The pandemic, who knows what that direction that goes in, especially with regards to his health protest. Amy Coney Barrett, I'd actually argue, is probably a little more predictable than these other things. But the question, Dave, is what can Trump really do to reverse this tide at this point?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that when we've looked at this over time, at the end of March, President Trump was at his high point in terms of approval, job approval. All of the betting pools had him as the odds-on favorite to be reelected. He had approval on what he was doing on COVID. He started to take it seriously. But from March 31st on, over the next, especially when he started those news conferences, his approval rating fell dramatically. He had 20% of Democrats who were approving of him on COVID, his handling of COVID. That's five. He had 59% of independents approving of his performance on COVID. That's down to in the 30s now. And among Republicans, he dropped fewer Republicans approve. It went from 7% who disapproved to 16% disapproving of his handling of COVID. And the more you disapprove of his handling of COVID, the more likely you are to vote against it. Now, obviously, Republicans are not going to vote against Trump as much as Democrats who disapprove of his handling of COVID, but still you got 14-15% of Republicans who disapprove of him on COVID who are going to vote for Biden. And so if the election's about COVID and coronavirus, then I don't see what the president can do. He's come back and he said, I'm feeling good, don't let it define your idea, but it's defensive. And I guess the idea of turning down the remote debate is because it puts too much emphasis on the coronavirus, but I don't see how turning down the debate helps him in any way, shape, or form. If the protests got out of hand, and I know some people feel they're already out of hand, but what I mean by out of hand is there's a significant number of people who now, particularly in the battleground states, are willing to vote on that basis, then that helps Trump. Right. But so far, I don't really see that. I haven't seen much of it in the news. There are protests. I've been trying to follow the papers in Wisconsin and other battleground states, but thus far we're not seeing that make a difference. Amy Coney Barrett, we'll see what happens on that. But in general, on that, thus far, the first 2 weeks of the polls, the people who are pro-life and they like what's going on. Pro-choice people don't like it a lot. And I don't see it changing very many votes at this point.
Yeah. And you mentioned Wisconsin, Dave, where the Kenosha situation might've played to Trump's advantage, but I'm looking now at the Real Clear Politics battleground averages right now. Wisconsin, these are October 8th numbers, Dave. Wisconsin, Biden's up 5.5% in their RCP average, 49.5 to 44. A few other states in here, by the way, Biden's up 40.
That's post-debate, Bill.
Yes, post-debate, yeah. Here's Biden up 4.5% in Florida, 7% in Pennsylvania, 6.2% in Michigan.
I've seen now three polls in Pennsylvania that I know and trust. And that was a state that was like down around 2.5 points. And I think the average is over 6 points now. So I think Florida's still close. But it does look to me like unless something happens in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan, in fact, a lot of people who do these predictions have now on their maps have painted Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin as slightly blue.
And the thing for Trump, Dave, is he has to find a way to make this not about Donald Trump, which I think almost goes against his political nature since he likes to drive the news every day via tweets, via press conferences. He likes to be the straw that stirs the drink, as I famously said about Reggie Jackson and the New York Yankees. But here's the problem. Elections, Dave, are choices. And right now, this is a referendum on Donald Trump, and he's losing the referendum. And you saw this in the debate last night between Kamala Harris and Mike Pence, where time and again, Pence tried to pin down Harris on positions that she and Joe Biden are purposely avoiding, such as the Green New Deal and whether or not to pack the Supreme Court. And what does she do? She quickly pushes back by denouncing Donald Trump. And so it's hard not to be Trump. So this, again, is the trick. You know, interesting thing about last night's debate, by the way, Dave, something which Harris missed pointing out, which I was surprised. That debate last night was a fourth anniversary of the dropping of the Access Hollywood tape, the famous grab them by the you-know-what tape.
Oh, yes.
And you would think that if she were really looking to kind of close the deal with suburban voters and college-educated women, two groups that Trump is having a real problem with, she would have mentioned that, but she didn't. But again, here's the problem. Here we are a day after that debate, and instead of trying to push the Biden-Harris ticket, Freudian slip, on these issues they're avoiding, it's all about the president once again and we're not in debate. So in other words, the president can't seem to get out of the way of himself.
No, I find it astonishing. So, for example, I called John Cogan the other day because I couldn't understand why the president would say we're not going to negotiate anymore.
John, a very prominent economist.
Yeah. I just called John. I said, John, am I missing something? I just don't understand why you would say you don't want to negotiate, because as you know, that bill might be important, things might be happening, and to come in and say, nope, it's over. And he didn't understand it either. So I felt pretty good about that I wasn't alone. And then today or yesterday he comes back in and says, well, we might begin to talk about it again. But all of that stuff just keeps the spotlight on him.
Right.
And if you're going to change things, you really do need to do exactly what you said. You need to make people start thinking about, gee, if the Democrats get in, won't it be too radical? Won't it be too much of a change? Mm-hmm. But as long as, and then today, all of the headlines were about President Trump saying he won't do the debate. If you keep doing that, then the tension never turns to Biden and Harris. And I don't see how you can, then it's all about you. And I agree that that's, you don't want it as a referendum on you.
Yeah, you know, interesting question coming out of this election of Biden does win, Dave, is the question of how good was Joe Biden and how lucky was Joe Biden. And by lucky, let me posit this to you. We're talking about this election back in February, and it is a very raucous Democratic primary process. You have Pete Buttigieg winning in Iowa, Bernie Sanders wins in New Hampshire, Biden wins in South Carolina. There are questions about Biden's stability as a front runner. There are questions about how the Bernie side and then whoever is the mainstream nominee, how they're going to make peace come to convention in Milwaukee. And while you have a pretty strong economy, this all points to the incumbent getting reelected. And then March comes in, Dave, and bang, what changes? Now suddenly, Trump is a president who has to handle a crisis, which is not his forte. That's probably not the bargain the American people made in 2016 in electing him. And the Democratic primaries, they pretty much vanished, Dave, a few votes, but it's pretty much over and Biden's the nominee. And on top of that, Dave, because of the quarantine, because of COVID, Biden can stay off the campaign trail for months on end to the fear that he'll go out and he'll be a daily gaffe machine and people will think he's unsteady and wobbly. He stays out of the spotlight, instead giving Donald Trump the spotlight. And as we talked about, Trump becomes the topic and becomes a referendum on Trump. So the Biden campaign has been very good, Dave, in terms of a lot of its strategy and a lot of very simple things he's done. I'll give you an example. They've been clever at times. Last night, for example, the buzz coming out of the vice presidential debate, part of which was a fly that landed on the head of Vice President Pence. Of course, is a thing that sets the internet off with memes. The Biden campaign was very quick on its feet, Dave, and they quickly put out on its website a fly swatter for sale. That's kind of clever when you think about it.
It is.
It's rather nimble thinking, if you will. But they've been good, but they've been lucky. And you look at the Trump campaign, Dave, and you ask the question, you know, is he just kind of star-crossed?
And here,
let me not just dominate this conversation, but here, I take this personally, Dave. Why? In 1992, I was an underling in the Bush-Quayle campaign.
Yes.
And if you were to teach a course at Stanford about just unfortunate campaigns, campaigns kind of dubiously managed, campaigns with bad luck, I will come give a lecture.
Yes. Or how about in 96 when you were on the Pete Wilson campaign and then all of a sudden he couldn't talk.
Well,
you can do that. You can come and talk on that. I agree with absolutely everything you said about the Biden campaign. Another part of the luck was they're lucky it's Donald Trump, the opponent, because if you think about the Democratic Party, is quite heterogeneous. They have the AOC, very liberal, Elizabeth Warren wing. They have 35-40% moderates, and they have sort of in the center, they're liberals. Mm-hmm. And thus far, the battle has been silenced because the very liberal and the liberals, they do not like Donald Trump. They want to see him beaten. But I assure you that Biden's luck, if he wins, runs out immediately upon his election. And on Inauguration Day, all of the uncertainty and differences in the Democratic Party are going to come to the fore. And they are going to try, the left is going to try and push Biden to the left. Is he going to be in the center? Where is he going to be? And the trouble starts for Biden the day he gets elected, because that heterogeneous, divisive Democratic Party is going to be all over.
Yeah, you raise a very good point. If he's elected, he now has to form a cabinet. He has to make appointments, and he has to indicate what his priorities are, all things which he is, you know, very smartly ducking right now. And also consider this scenario, Dave, getting back to the idea of Trump walking away from the COVID relief negotiations. Let's say that Biden wins. Let's say that Trump is a lame duck and cannot pull off a package with Nancy Pelosi. I'm not sure. Maybe he'd want to deal with her. Maybe he just want to pack up his toys and go home, or maybe she just feels she could get a better deal with Biden. So if this rolls over, over into January with Joe Biden, Dave, I'd contend that this now has to be issue number one for him in his presidency. Yeah. Always a question, what is the first bill in Congress, the first act of Congress, if you have the president in your corner? It's going to be a COVID package. Well, okay, they can maybe come together and do something quick, but here's the challenge with that, Dave. It's going to cost a lot of money to do a COVID package, a couple of trillion dollars, let's assume. That's a couple of trillion dollars less you can't spend on some healthcare expansion, on the Green New Deal, infrastructure, whatever the big spending ideas the Democrats have. So now he has to make choices.
I agree, absolutely. That is not his his life during the campaign, as for the reasons you pointed out rather eloquently before, are exactly right. His life gets a lot tougher. If he gets elected, that's when it gets tough for him.
It does. This is a very non-politically scientific question, but does luck, Dave, ever factor into polling? In other words, do voters look at the new candidates and think, you know, this guy just seems to have the wind at his sails, and this guy just can't seem to catch a break? Because again, I go back to my 1992 experience with George H.W. Bush, and it was just kind of a long series of events going back to, remember when he threw up when he went to Japan?
I do remember that.
Yeah, he went to New Hampshire and said, "Message, I care." He had the famous debate incident, which is maybe kind of the closing of it. Remember they had all three of them, he, Clinton, and Perot, were on the debate stage, and this is the first year, Dave, they did a town hall debate, and they did it in Richmond. And remember, they had kind of a random group of people to pick for this thing, including one kind of odd bearded guy, the kind of guy who, you know, works in university bookstores, you know the type. Yeah. He just gave this oddball, long-winded question. There's a president of the United States looking down at his wristwatch.
Yeah.
It was all when right. And I'm not saying that a fly landing on the vice president's head is in the same league as that. But again, I just kind of wonder, Dave, at some point, if voters just start to close the book on a campaign, just thinking that, you know, what can happen to these guys next, given that the fly landing on Pence's head is just a week after, irony of ironies, Donald Trump and a lot of people around him catching COVID.
No, you've given good examples of exactly why it's there and why polling is a good part science, and it's also a good part art, and that's one of the reasons why there's an art part to it that is a lot harder to understand and get a feel for.
Very good. You watch the polls every week, Dave. Is there anything on the polling radar that you think is kind of going unnoticed here by the media in terms of what the public is itching for? You know, last night, for example, they actually talked about foreign policy, which was something that went largely missing in the Cleveland debate. But is there anything as a sleeper issue out there that's catching you? Or if I assume correctly, this is about...
The issue that seemed to me to, in previous work that I did, seemed to help Trump in battleground states was this protest issue. The way we asked it was, the question was asked, do you think that the... protests were mainly violent or mainly peaceful. And so as you might expect, it breaks down by party line. So about 15% of Democrats said they were mainly violent. Among Republicans, 72%. But among independents, it was 40% said they were mainly violent. But then when you went into battleground states, among Democrats, it was 19%. Among Republicans, it was 80%. And among independents, it was right at 50%. And then of those people who thought it was mainly violent, they were overwhelmingly voting for, among Democrats who thought it was, there were 25% were going to vote for Trump. And so the Trump, that helped Trump. The national press, the media has not played that up recently. And we didn't ask a question on that last week or so. So I'm lobbying to get that question in this week. That's the one thing I could see, that if it blows up, or maybe because it hasn't been reported on, it's still there and we haven't measured it. So that's the one thing I'm looking at. And maybe the Amy Comey Barrett case, will come to the fore. But I have my doubts about that, as I've said before.
I did too, Dave, for this reason. It just seems kind of locked in. She's not a mystery. She's been through this process before. I think if you're the Democrats and you're making this calculation, you know, it's a Napoleonic creed. Why destroy your enemy when it's in the process of destroying itself? It's why attack her? Why give Trump an opening, if you will? Why make her seem sympathetic? Why point out the issue of judges? Why by doing this, it goes again to the question of packing the Supreme Court, goes to the question of who Trump, Biden would pick with a Supreme Court nominee if such a vacancy were open. In other words, yeah, you're gonna question her. You're gonna talk about Roe v. Wade and abortion, I guess, because that's what the base wants to hear. But you're not gonna do to her what you did to Brett Kavanaugh, because I think that just risks a backlash. And again, if you believe these polls, and he's up by 9% nationally, and he's up by 4 to 5 points, and most of the states are gonna decide this thing, why would you rock the cradle by doing that?
Yeah, I agree with that. And the other thing, though, that plays into this of interest is you have two Republican members of the Judiciary Committee who now have COVID, and there may be others. And so the result of that, this may delay the hearing somewhat, because now the battle will be over, can you vote remotely? Right. And again, all that does is put the emphasis on the coronavirus and not on the issue.
So I'm a step ahead of you on this one, Dave. I did a podcast last week with John Yoo, our colleague here at Hoover, constitutional lawyer extraordinaire. John worked on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and what he seems to think would happen is what they would have a virtual vote on the nomination. It would get passed out. Here's the question, though, Dave. Moving forward, though, it's not just the two Republicans on the Judiciary Committee, Tillis and Lee, who have coronavirus. It's also Johnson from Wisconsin, who also has it as well. Coupled with the fact that maybe Susan Collins would pass on voting for this because she said that she thinks this is not the right time to be doing this. Same for Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. McConnell might not be able to get 50 votes, John, which means that he would have to do some sort of quorum absent senators voting trick to get this thing done. So it could play out. It could play out in kind of more scorched earth in that regard. And again, here's a challenge for the Democrats. If McConnell really does, you know, kind of fiddle around with rules and, you know, go to parliamentary extremes to get this done, do you take the bait? It's kind of similar, if you think about it, to Trump and Pelosi and the coronavirus negotiations, where I'd contend to you that she did not want to do a deal with him all right along, and she waited for him to lose his patience and back out, and he fell into the trap and he did it. Again, getting back to the idea, if you have a lead, don't mess with it. Again, why would you have a huge public fit if you're Chuck Schumer and the Democrats and kind of raise this issue of court packing, which, by the way, Dave, I don't know if you're polling. I'm curious if you guys have polled on it, if you're going to, because it must pull wretchedly, because otherwise, why would Kamala Harris and Joe Biden avoid this thing like the plague?
Well, I think, I don't know if it, I'm not sure, it might, we haven't asked yet, but it might, we're thinking about it. It might poll pretty well among Democrats, but right, the reason they back off is for the reason you said already. If whatever you say on that, it would just get you in trouble, right? If you say, yeah, we're going to pack the court, boom, you get hit. If you say, no, we're not going to pack the court, then the left comes in against you. So until the election, I assure you they're going to do exactly what you just said they have been doing. They're not going to comment on it. They're going to wait. And we'll see what they do. But I do guarantee you there'll be pressure from the left in the party to say, let's pack the court. There'll also be pressure to say statehood for DC and Puerto Rico.
Okay, but why would I push that if I'm the Democrats, Dave? Because again, look at the practical political consideration of this. It's never going to happen.
Yes,
you can put it in Congress if you could somehow get a 2/3 vote and get it out. There'll be 14 or 15 states certain to oppose it. It's not going to happen. So again, why be Don Quixote? Why yes, tilt into windmill?
Agreed.
Okay, let's wind this down, Dave. When you see a poll that shows a 16-point national lead, a poll that shows a 14-point national lead, that is dramatic, but it also begs the question of whether or not pollsters are leading with their chin and begging for repudiation on election day. How confident are you right now in the polling process?
I think the polling process, so first of all, as you and I and Doug have always said, the best thing you can do is sort of look at averages. There are several places that do that. Real Clear Politics is the place I look at. They take an average of polls. So if some polls are off one way, others are off the other way, you kind of normalize that. 538 does a pretty good job of averaging all of the state polls. And our colleague John Cogan has done some interesting work showing battleground states are pretty close as measured that way. So that's one average one. And then the other one is you have to look pretty carefully at what the polls are doing. And I think polls that don't move around very much are also better polls. And of course, I personally think that the Economist YouGov poll is one of the best because we have really good people, including Doug Rivers of Hoover on it.
Okay. So again, to conclude, you think it's more of a 9-point race nationally?
Absolutely. I agree. It's 8 to 10 points, but I'd say eight or nine. Yes.
Okay. And
that's a big amount as you.
It is. Four to five in the battlegrounds. And can Trump make this up?
He can, but he better hurry. If you ask me the scenario where he makes it up, you know, so at the end, when you compare him to where he was with Hillary, and I've done some of that actual dead comparisons between Hillary in 2016 and this week and Biden in this week by race, by gender, by age, by all of the four, by the gaps in American politics. And Joe Biden is in every one of those dimensions running ahead of where Hillary Clinton was. And so you got to remember, even though it's a battleground states, he's doing in the battleground states, he's running ahead of where she was. And in the end, it was only 77,000 votes in three states. So, I think the president is in a hole and he's got to do something to turn it around pretty quickly.
I'm reminded, Dave, of another Dave, the late Dave Zinkoff. Everybody wondering who the heck is he? Dave Zinkoff was a PA announcer, a sports PA announcer in Philadelphia, Dave, for years. He did the Phillies games all the way back at Scheib Park. He did the Philadelphia Warriors games before they came out west to the Bay Area. And he did the Philadelphia 76ers games. I remember watching a game on TV one time, Dave, where he was doing these announcements. Somebody had left the lights on in their car out in the parking lot. So the first quarter, well, the owner of a Chevrolet, blah, 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 your lights are on. And then the second quarter, Dave, blah, 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 the owner, your lights are on. In the third quarter, your lights are on. And then finally, Dave, in the fourth quarter, your lights are on. And then he pauses and he goes, but they're getting dimmer.
Yeah.
And I kind of, you look at this election right now, 26 days to go. And to the extent there's a Trump rally, you get the feeling the lights are on, but they're getting dimmer.
Right. I agree.
Okay, a great conversation. Let's have you back before the election, and let's go track down that scoundrel of your colleague, Doug Rivers, and get him on too. And let's make him cough up some polling numbers, okay?
Great, thanks.
Okay, Dave, enjoy the conversation.
Thanks, Bill.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. Tell your friends about us. Get them to have a listen. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows. That includes Dave Brady, straight to your inbox weekdays. Speaking of which, Dave's defining article, defining ideas article that I mentioned, you can find it on the Hoover website. You can actually find it most easily by going and tracking down Dave Brady's bio, and you'll find it right there. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Till then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.